Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. On today's program, we'll be answering questions, as we do from time to time, on COVID-19 and vaccines. But up front, monoclonal antibody treatments may be the best thing short of a vaccine to prevent serious illness, hospitalization, and death from the virus. In fact, there's evidence the antibody treatment can do just that by 70%. Monoclonal antibody treatment is a one-time treatment given intravenously. It involves copies of antibodies which seek out the COVID-19 virus and prevent it from infecting the cells and reproducing. But not everyone qualifies, and maybe the treatment can be used more often. Joining us on today's program, Dr. Richard Wattis, who is emergency medicine physician and co-lead of UPMC's monoclonal antibody research. Dr. Wattis, welcome to the program. Dr. John Goldman, infectious disease specialist with UPMC. Gentlemen, both of you, thank you for coming on today's program. Let's start with, what is monoclonal antibodies? Dr. Wattis, what is it?
Thanks, Scott. So monoclonal antibodies have been used for a variety of conditions, mostly immune-related conditions for some time. You can think of things like rheumatoid arthritis and Crohn's disease. Many people have probably seen commercials on TV for things like psoriasis. That's been a popular one recently. However, since the COVID-19 pandemic began, some of our pharmaceutical companies have been trying to develop these monoclonal antibodies to fight the virus. And so toward the end of last year, they were actually able to develop these monoclonal antibodies specifically directed at the COVID-19 virus. And so in November of last year, the FDA issued an emergency use authorization to allow for the use of these medications to treat COVID-19.
So I gave a brief explanation of how they work in my introduction, but I'm sure you'd have a much better explanation and definition of how they do work. Can you explain that?
Sure. So the primary way that these medications work is very similar to the natural antibodies that your body develops against bacteria or viruses. These human-made antibodies are actually tailored such that they can identify the spike protein on the virus. Many of you have heard about the spike protein as a very unique characteristic of the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19. And the pharmaceutical companies have been able to develop this antibody that targets that spike protein. The reason that's important is because the spike protein actually allows the virus to get into our human cells, which is then how it causes illness. And so by blocking that process, the virus cannot get into the cells and doesn't cause all of the symptoms that we've become accustomed to seeing with patients who suffer from COVID-19.
Are there any similarities with the vaccines that are available and are being given right now?
This therapy is certainly different than vaccines. And the way I would think about it is the monoclonal antibody could be thought of as the product of a vaccine, so to speak. So the vaccine given to a patient would cause your body to create antibodies against the virus. The monoclonal antibody that's manufactured is actually given to you, already ready to go, able to start fighting the virus immediately, as opposed to having to wait for a vaccine to cause your body to start to make antibodies that to then be ready to respond to the virus.
So a big difference, of course, then the vaccine is preventive, where the antibody treatment is a treatment after someone has been exposed to the vaccine. Tell me now, I know there are some particulars for who and when someone can receive monoclonal antibody treatments. Talk about that if you would.
Sure, that's a great question. So not, as you mentioned in your opening statement, not everyone qualifies. And when I say qualifies, the qualification is based on the emergency use authorization that was issued by the FDA at the end of last year. And so it was geared towards patients who were felt to be at higher risk for suffering from the consequences of COVID-19. Those kinds of patients would be folks who are moderately overweight with a BMI greater than 35, people with underlying medical conditions such as chronic kidney disease or diabetes, or have some other problem with their immune system, or are taking medications that would impact their immune system such that they may not be able to respond to the virus as quickly as someone not on those medications. That's the primary group as far as the medical piece of it goes. Also, people age greater than 65 or people greater than 55 who have some underlying medical problems, such as any kind of heart disease or high blood pressure, chronic lung disease, all of those folks would also qualify. And then there's a special carve out of patients who qualify between the ages of 12 and 17, who again, either are moderately overweight or have an underlying significant medical problem. Maybe they were born with some sort of heart abnormality or some sort of developmental disorder, those kinds of things, significant asthma. Those types of underlying illnesses would also qualify them for treatment with the monoclonal antibodies.
If you're just tuning in, during this portion of the program, we're focusing on monoclonal antibody treatments for COVID-19, but a little bit later, we're going to be taking the broad questions, all the questions you have about COVID-19 and the vaccine with Dr. Goldman. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. John Goldman, as an infectious disease specialist who has treated those with COVID, have you utilized the monoclonal antibody treatment?
Absolutely. So we're utilizing, we're giving probably 4, 5 to 6 a day, either in patients who are outpatients who is Dr. Wada said, aren't hospitalized, don't need oxygen. And within, I believe, 10 days of exposure, we're able to give it through our outpatient infusion centers. We're able to give it in the ER. And so this is something where we've started to use the monoclonal antibodies much more frequently. And we think they're having a good effect. We think that they are preventing people from getting sick. We think they're preventing people from being hospitalized.
Outpatient infusion centers, what are those? I mean, I think the name is pretty self-explanatory, so but talk about that.
The issue is that the monoclonal antibodies have to be infused over roughly an hour. The patient has to be monitored for allergic reaction, and you have to be prepared to deal with the allergic reactions. As you can imagine, it's a little bit of a logistical issue because we are bringing people into the hospital or into an infusion center who are at the height of their COVID infectivity. So we have very good established protocols so that we can do that safely. We have good, well established protocols so that we can monitor the patients, and we're using this much more frequently.
You said about to monitor for allergic reactions, and for those that don't know, the same is done for 15 minutes after someone receives a vaccination. Have there been patients that have been allergic to the monoclonal antibody treatments?
Had minor reactions. Someone gets a fever. Unfortunately, it's not always clear whether they're getting a fever from the monoclonal antibody or they're getting a fever from COVID. We have not had major reactions. My understanding is that the major reactions occur in roughly 1 out of every 1,000,000 infusions. We haven't come anywhere close to doing a million infusions yet. And so we have not seen any major reactions, nothing more than a little bit of a fever during the infusions. And obviously, though, because they occur, you have to be prepared for them.
Dr. Goldman, something you mentioned, you know, as you were listing kind of the qualifications as part of this, of who actually gets the treatments, you mentioned someone that within a certain amount of time has tested positive for COVID-19. Is that a prerequisite for getting these treatments, that there has to be a certain amount of time that has elapsed since they were tested positive?
It's usually a certain amount of time between the onset of symptoms. It's roughly 10 days, and it's because you would like to catch this early in the course of the disease. I believe the emergency use authorization always also specifies that it has to be within 10 days of infusion. So it's actually one of the requirements from the government as to when we can infuse it.
And you said the onset of symptoms. So someone who has tested positive but is not showing symptoms would not be eligible for this?
Absolutely. Someone who is tested positive but doesn't have symptoms would be eligible. We would just use the date of their vaccine, or I'm sorry, of their test as the start of the 10 days.
Okay.
Part of the issue is that there are some people who have very mild symptoms, and when we go back and we ask them, they'll say, well, they started a couple of days ago. And there's some people who are completely asymptomatic. If they're completely asymptomatic, we would use the date of the test as the start of the clock.
Dr. Wattis, I think it was, I wanted to make sure that Dr. Goldman was able to talk about some of the logistics of administering these treatments. But here's the big question that many people have. If this treatment is so effective, why isn't everyone getting this? And this is actually coming from a listener.
Sure. That is a very pertinent question, and I'm very happy that you asked it. So one of the things that we have found with any new treatment, any new therapy that comes along, is people tend to be a little bit hesitant about it. One of the common misconceptions about this treatment, both for providers as well as patients, is that it is experimental. It actually is not experimental. It is not research. It is authorized by the FDA based on all of the information that they have, and they felt comfortable that the risk and the benefits are favorable to give the medication. As you heard Dr. Goldman mention, the side effects that we've seen, if anyone has had any, are very, very mild. We have not seen any significant reactions. And so part of the issue, aside from that, is just getting the word out. And what we have done here at UPMC is we have worked very hard with our marketing and public relations teams to get as much information as we can out to both providers and to the communities that we serve, to let them know that this treatment is available, that it has been studied, and we continue to study it. We will continue to study and do and learn more from what we do on a daily basis. And just get the word out to the public in general about the therapy being available if they qualify.
Do all hospitals, is this treatment available for all hospitals to administer?
So it would be available in terms of any hospital could choose to do it. Some hospitals have had very limited use with it, where they've given just a few doses. There's been variable, buy-in to the therapy. However, based on the data that we have, even from our own internal data of about 400 patients, that's where we found that there's been a significant decrease in hospitalizations and death based on that. And that's 400 of our own patients here in Pennsylvania. That we've looked at and studied to see what were the outcomes in those patients compared to patients of similar nature who did not receive monoclonal antibodies, and what was the difference in outcomes. We've now done well over 1,300 infusions, and we continue to hear stories from patients regarding how much they thought it helped them, such that within hours to a day after receiving the treatment, they have felt dramatically improved.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest on this portion of today's program, Dr. Richard Wattis, emergency medicine physician and co-lead of UPMC's monoclonal antibody program, and Dr. John Goldman, infectious disease specialist with UPMC. We're talking about monoclonal antibody treatments, and we'll be talking generally about and taking your questions, your broad questions on the vaccines and COVID-19 in just a few minutes. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Wattis, one of the questions I'm sure many people have is this costly? Is this something that would cost them out-of-pocket money, or is it something that is covered by insurance?
In our experience thus far, we know that the insurers have had their own specific interpretation of how this is, when it's given, what they're going to cover, et cetera. So each insurer may be a little bit different. We have been encouraging patients to check with their insurers regarding any of those kinds of questions. As you might imagine, with all of the different insurers that are out there, there isn't really consensus. What I can tell you, which is very, very good news, is that this medication is still being completely funded by the federal government. So far and away, the most costly part of this endeavor is the medication, and the federal government's covering the cost of that at 100%. I can tell you from our system, from UPMC system, that our UPMC health plan is covering the cost completely for these outpatient infusions at this point for our patients. Mm-hmm. And so what we have been recommending again to people is just to check with their insurance to see if they would be responsible for any sort of copay or deductible or those kinds of things. But the medication itself is free.
We had a question from a listener about whether this treatment is effective against the variants, the other forms of COVID that we've heard so much about and have been spreading more often here in the United States. Is it effective?
So there has been one minor change. Initially, there was a single medication that was part of the infusion from one of the pharmaceutical companies. They have since developed another monoclonal antibody, and we've added that monoclonal antibody to the initial single, the single medication. And so now there are two authorized courses of medication, two drugs given at the same time, and they have shown to be effective against the variants as well. So even in such a short time, the science has progressed and we've learned enough that we've been able to adjust. And so the medication remains very, very effective, even against the variants.
You mentioned that there has been variable buy-in. I think that's those are the words that you used. In fact, from what I understand, there are doctors in this country, maybe even in this state, that are not aware of this treatment, and maybe some that are aware but haven't been recommending it, haven't been utilizing it for their COVID patients. Why not? And, I mean, how do we get to a point where we actually have doctors that aren't aware of this?
Again, we're only really a few months into the availability of these medications. And depending on where you practice, what kind of medicine you practice, you may or may not have come across this. Maybe you don't treat very many COVID patients in your day-to-day work life. And so some of it is awareness, as you mentioned. Some of it is physicians want to see more evidence. They want to see more studies. However, as I mentioned, with the FDA, we're balancing the information that we have with what we've been able to learn as we go with the risk. And because the risk certainly seemed to be very, very low, the upside seems significant. And that's part of the message that we need to get out.
Is there a perception issue as well? I mean, former President Trump received this treatment, and I think the stories in the media after he recovered so quickly, and there were many people who maybe got the perception is, oh, the President of the United States got this treatment, this is for special people, that this is for a certain class of people, that this is not for your regular run-of-the-mill COVID patient. Is there that perception out there?
I think there is some of that perception. But what we've done to dispel that myth, I think, is reach out to our communities, all of our communities that UPMC serves across the Commonwealth, to get people to understand that it is available to them if they meet the criteria under the FDA. If I remember the timing correctly, when the former president received the drug, it actually did not have authorization. If you remember, they did refer to it as experimental. We are way past that now. We have substantial experience now, and it is for, in our minds, it is for everyone who qualifies under the guidelines from the FDA. And we are actively reaching out to patients in all of our communities to try to get them the information that they need to make a decision in an attempt to treat everybody who can be treated.
And I know that there will be people even listening to this program today who may have been tested positive, who will ask, is that something they should do with their physician? Ask for this treatment or ask about this treatment if their doctor, their physician doesn't say, hey, here's an option.
We've had that come up numerous times. And again, especially early on, many physicians weren't familiar with the medications. And so what I would tell patients is if they ask their physician's on SRUR, we can certainly be a resource for that. If the patient wants to reach out to us directly, one of the things that we've done is we've created a mechanism for patients to reach out directly to us. There's a phone number on our upmc.com website that a patient can call and be connected with a nurse who can help them navigate this. And we can help facilitate either that conversation or facilitate the infusion if need be.
Dr. Wattis, I know you have to run here in just a few minutes, and I want to thank you very much for being on the program today. Is this a game changer? I mean, it's still experimental, but it has gotten emergency approval by the FDA. Do you see this as being so significant that it could be called a game changer?
So I'll jump in and discount the word experimental, because I think we are,
okay,
we may do experiments with it down the road to learn more about it. Maybe there's other indications, maybe there's other populations that benefit, but for the uses that we're using it right now, you're exactly right, authorized. And so right now at this moment, in the place that we are with COVID-19, it is changing the game for a lot of patients. It really is making a significant impact on their disease progression and on their symptomatology. And as we progress, hopefully toward the end of the pandemic, I think it will still be an important therapy for patients who don't or can't get vaccinated or don't respond to vaccination. For them, I think it'll continue to be a tremendous benefit. Will it always be that 70% that you mentioned early on? It may not be. It may be a little bit less. But we have few other therapies, really, that are that effective, particularly against viral diseases, which are historically difficult to treat in many ways. So I do think it'll continue to be of tremendous benefit.
Dr. Richard Wattis is emergency medicine physician and co-lead of UPMC's monoclonal antibody program. Dr. Wattis, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. John Goldman, UPMC infectious disease specialist, is sticking around with us and can answer some of the monoclonal questions as well. But we'll take basically any kind of question about COVID-19 or the vaccines. If you have one over the next half hour, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Goldman, we have a couple more monoclonal questions here. Scott asks, he says, I have a friend who has had COVID for over a month and is overweight. Would this work for him and would he be eligible?
So he would not be eligible because he's outside of the window in which we could give the monoclonal antibody. So in addition, this is kind of wonky, but when you have the virus, the symptoms initially, it's thought you're in the viral replicative phase, meaning the virus is actively dividing, is actively going through your body. And some of the long-term symptoms are thought to be more as a result of an immune response. So there is some concern that if you give it late, you may augment the immune response and make some of those symptoms worse, which is one of the reasons we try to give it early rather than late in the course of the disease.
So that time window is important.
That time window is important. It's not well established what happens if you give it outside of that time window. But one of the issues with COVID is you have to separate the infection, the results of the infection from the COVID virus with the results of the your body's immune response. It's important to give the antibody early because it's thought that if you give it early, it helps shut down the virus more quickly.
Another question from a listener says, my sister-in-law is pregnant and got COVID when she was about 3 months pregnant. My question is, how would this treatment help or hinder women who are pregnant, women who are just who have just recently gave birth, or their newborn babies?
So, first of all, the vaccines and the antibodies, it's not as well established what to do for pregnant women. However, the vaccine, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology specifically says that pregnant women should not be excluded from it. And one of the problem and one of the issues is pregnant women tend to do pretty well. That's because they tend to be young, healthy people. On the other hand, the pregnant women frequently, pregnant women do worse than young, healthy women the same age. So if you look at the United States, the maternal mortality is fortunately very low, 4 deaths per 100,000 births, 4 deaths of women per 100,000 births. With COVID, it actually goes up by a lot to 104 deaths per 100,000 births. So first of all, I usually recommend the vaccine in pregnant women. And I would recommend the antibody in pregnant women because I think it prevents them from getting severe disease. In addition, the antibody hasn't been well studied in pregnant women, but it's an antibody. It's an antibody, and it's unlikely to cause problems for the baby. And if it will, through placental transfer, protect the baby, the mother is breastfeeding, the baby will get either the antibodies from the vaccine or the antibodies from the monoclonal antibody passively through the breast milk.
Yeah, we had that exact question from another listener, wanted to know whether breastfeeding, that the antibodies would be passed on to the kids. Also wanted to know whether people donating breast milk, whether that is something that would be recommended if the mother has contracted COVID.
So for people donating breast milk, I think that it would almost certain, if the mother has contracted COVID, it would almost certainly protect the baby. Typically, they would have someone wait 10 to 20 days before donating breast milk. I don't think there has ever been any transmission via breast milk, but I can't imagine that they would be comfortable having milk donated in the phase of active infection.
Dr. Goldman, here's a non-treatment question, or I should say a non-monoclonal antibody treatment question. Reports on new variants are spreading faster with kids in schools. Can you speak to the changing nature of the virus and what precautions should be taken with kids?
So a lot of this isn't really well established. What we do know is a couple of things. The new variants are clearly more infectious. So, for example, the UK variant, which right now in Pennsylvania is the predominant variant. And I expect that's going to increase, not decrease, because the virus is more infectious, it will reproduce itself. The new variants will reproduce themselves more effectively than the old variants. And I expect during a short period of time, we're going to see mostly new variants in our area. We know that it's more infectious. There is some evidence that it causes more morbidity, more hospitalizations, more deaths, but that's not clear yet. And there's some evidence that it causes more disease in young people. That's also not clear. What I think is happening is that right now we're doing a good job of vaccinating our vulnerable population. And so we've vaccinated a higher percentage of patients who are older and have raised patients who have other medical conditions. As a result, what we're left with is the patients who are still susceptible to the virus are younger. So it doesn't surprise me that we're seeing more young patients because that's who the virus can infect. And if the variant is more infectious, the variants will be more, and the young people will have the variant. That's what most people are infected by in central Pennsylvania. And if it's a little more, if it's a little more potent, if it causes more deaths and hospitalizations, it doesn't surprise me that the young people have more symptoms. Now, when we've tried to go back and say, look, are we seeing more young, healthy people hospitalized at UPMC? We really haven't seen that yet. Again, it's early. Again, these things are sometimes hard to determine. The good news is that despite the perception that across the country, because of the new variants, we're seeing more young, healthy people infected. We have not yet to see that. We haven't seen that yet at UPMC.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, earlier this week, we talked about tinnitus and the ringing in the ears, as most people describe it, or many people describe it. We had a follow-up from a listener who said, well, how about talking about noise pollution? So that's what we're going to do tomorrow on the program, talk about noise pollution. Also, the new move-over law on Pennsylvania roads. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Our guest today is Dr. John Goldman, infectious disease specialist with UPMC. If you have a COVID-19 question, maybe a question about the vaccine, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Susan in Lancaster. Susan, you're on Smart Talk.
Yeah, hi, Scott. This is interesting. I have a question about something that I am not really sure about being vaccinated. Now, I just got my first vaccine shot, and I'm due May 4th for my second. Now, in a perfect world, theoretically, if I'm exposed to the virus, my vaccine is going to go to work with my immune system and keep me from getting sick. But during that interval that the vaccine is working within my body to protect me after being exposed, can I transmit it to somebody that hasn't been vaccinated? You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, we know what you mean, because this is a question that has come up fairly often, and not just between the first and second shot, but actually even after the second shot. Susan, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Goldman, I know times that you've been on our program in the past, we are asked this question fairly often, but let's talk about the scenario that Susan laid out first, between first and second shot.
So that's an extremely good question. Now, first of all, the vaccine has been shown to be very effective at preventing transmission. Israel, which vaccinated most of its population, has a 96% decrease in cases. So we know that the vaccine appears to prevent both infection and transmission. Second of all, if you do get the virus, either after the vaccine or in between the first and second shot, you absolutely can transmit it to other people. However, one of the things we know is that if the vaccine not only prevents disease, but prevents severe disease. So the vaccines are something like 100% effective at preventing hospitalization and death. It is very likely that if you get COVID, despite having the vaccine, either after a full dose or in between the first and second dose, that you're going to get less sick, that you're going to have lower levels of the virus in your body, and you will have lower levels to cough out and infect other people. So what I tell people is that we know that the vaccine prevents disease. We know the vaccine prevents hospitalizations and death. We know that in a population, when you vaccinate everyone, the levels of the rates of the virus go way, way down. And we think that if you have a breakthrough infection, despite having the vaccine, you can still transmit the virus, but you are less likely to transmit it to other people.
I would assume then that, I won't answer the question for you. I'll ask the question this way.
Certainly.
Should precautions still be taken, mitigation precautions like mask and social distancing, even after you have received the vaccination?
So I think once you have between the first and second dose, you should still do standard precautions, because we know that the vaccine probably at about 2 weeks becomes 50% effective. The vaccines by the time you're done with your second dose, probably 80 to 90% after you're done with your a week to 2 weeks after your third dose, depending on the vaccine, can get as high as 90%. There is still a lot of disease in our area. And so as a result, for example, I had the vaccine in late December, early January, and still wear a mask in public. For example, I have parents who are older, and I will see them without a mask on, but I don't do some of the very high risk activity, such as eating with them. So I still take precautions simply because there's a lot of disease in our area. Once that disease goes, the activity goes down, I plan to take less precautions.
And, you know, this is kind of an inside thing between Dr. Goldman and me, but Dr. Goldman's mother listens. I don't know about your father, but your mother listens to the program all the time. Has she been vaccinated?
Oh, yeah. Both of my parents have been vaccinated. And both of my parents listen to the program, but I think my mother is the only one that has the crush on me.
Well, I want to thank her for that. RJ tweets, what are your recommendations for those who hesitate to get the vaccine because they think there will be side effects? We've heard often about side effects, especially with the second shot.
So I would argue that we have to do simple risk analysis. So currently, roughly one out of every 500 Pennsylvanians has died of this virus. That's a lot. The life expectancy in this country has gone down by a full year during the last year, specifically because of COVID. And the risk of the virus is pretty high. Normally, when we vaccinate for rabies, for example, there have been 18 cases in the last 20 years. We give thousands of rabies shots. There's 25 to 50 cases of measles every year. We give everyone a measles shot. On the other hand, we have 4,000 to 5,000 cases in Pennsylvania every day. So your risk of dying of the virus is pretty high. Your risk of being hospitalized is probably one out of every 50 Pennsylvanians has ended up in the hospital because of this. And the worst side effect from the vaccine is anaphylaxis, a severe allergic reaction. It occurs in roughly one out of every 100,000 cases of Pfizer, run about out of every million cases of Moderna. So your risks of dying from the virus, not just your risk of being hospitalized, not just your risk of being very sick, are 200 to 2,000 times higher than your risk of the most severe non-fatal reaction from the vaccine. People also worry that, well, this hasn't been around very long and we're going to find out other side effects. And that's absolutely true. So for example, the AstraZeneca vaccine, roughly in the one out of every million range, seems to produce blood clots. Again, you're balancing the risk of a rare, one out of every million, one out of every 10 million occurrence with the vaccine, with a common, one out of every 500 rate of bad things, deaths. There are a lot of side effects with the second vaccine. A lot of people have fevers, a lot of people have chills, a lot of people miss work. On the other hand, if you get COVID, you're gonna feel a lot worse. And at this point in time, choosing not to get the vaccine is choosing to get the virus. In addition, you should never underestimate the risk to the people around you. I know a number of people who decided not to get the vaccine and infected loved ones, some of whom have died, some of whom have ended up severely ill. And so you're really basically taking the risk on getting 24 hours of the flu in order to protect both yourself and your loved ones from getting severely ill. I think that the risks of the virus far outweigh the risks of the vaccine. And you'll have to excuse me. I think getting vaccinated not only protects you, but protects your loved ones. And I think that we have an obligation to not only protect ourselves, but protect our friends and our family.
You know, unfortunately, there are people who have reasons that they've decided not to get vaccinated, some political, some that maybe don't think that COVID is as serious as what we've heard. Will we be able to achieve herd immunity in this country if we have a large segment of people who choose not to get vaccinated?
I think we, unfortunately, are going to achieve herd immunity one way or the other, by vaccination or by infection. So I do think that we will achieve herd immunity, because I think the people who choose not to be vaccinated will get immunity by getting infected. So at the current rate, we should be able to vaccinate 50% of the population by the end of June, 90% of the population by the end of July. That will be a game changer. That will decrease the rates of this disease to the point where we can go back to normal. We can go stop wearing masks. We can go to our favorite restaurants. We can go to our full crowds at our favorite sports teams. And I think, unfortunately, the people who are choosing not to get this vaccine are choosing to get COVID, will get infected. And as a result, we'll have herd immunity.
We have an email here that I have to say that, you know, for the thousands of families that have suffered from a death in the family, it's a tragedy for each family. But we have a listener from Mechanicsburg who says that my brother-in-law passed away yesterday from COVID. He was in the hospital since this past Saturday and was very ill. He was on a ventilator for an hour and then died. He didn't believe COVID was real. He was obese. Does that disqualify someone from the treatment? And I think she's talking about the monoclonal treatment. And I think that we established that, no, it wouldn't have disqualified him from. But if someone who is that ill, first of all, that listener, and I'm not going to mention your name, but very sorry for your loss. But, you know, Dr. Goldman, that's a perfect example. She said that her brother-in-law didn't believe. She thought that COVID wasn't real. And unfortunately, that gentleman found out that it is very real, and he lost his life as a result. But is someone too ill to receive the monoclonal antibody treatments?
Yeah, so a couple of things. First of all, I would just start out with, you have my deepest sympathies. And I think every death during this pandemic is tragic, whether or not people believe in COVID or not. I almost think that the people who don't believe in COVID, it's almost more tragic, because I think many of them were deliberately misinformed. I also, and second of all, the monoclonal antibody, one of the specific indications for it, regardless of your age, if you are obese, a body mass index above 35, you qualify for the antibody. So the early on, brother-in-law would have definitely qualified for the antibody because of the obesity. Once you get to the point where you're in the hospital, require oxygen indefinitely, if you're at the point you're on a ventilator, the monoclonal antibody is not given. We do things such as, we use steroids. If they're not on a ventilator, we use a drug called remdesivir, tocilizumab, which works against the cytokine storm, the overreaction of the body's immune system. So we have a number of other options, but the monoclonal antibody is for non-sick outpatients, not sick inpatients.
Dr. Goldman, we only have about a minute or so left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Did have another question from a listener. Bonnie asked, my husband recently had his teeth cleaned. His dentist and hygienist chose not to be vaccinated. Should I be concerned?
If your dentist and hygienist, I first of all would urge a dentist and hygienist to be vaccinated, because they're in close contact with people. The dentist and hygienist should be doing good precautions, which include N95 masks, gowning, a face shield, gowning. And if they do that, regardless of whether or not they're vaccinated, that should protect you. On the other hand, if they were vaccinated, it would be less risk to their patients.
You know, quickly, Dr. Goldman, I have to say that it's surprising to many people, the number of health professionals who have decided not to get vaccinated. And I only have about 30 seconds left.
It's quite honestly surprising to me. And we spend a lot of time trying to combat vaccine information. It proves that health professionals are just as susceptible to the same worries and fears that the rest of us are.
I mean, this can't be, well, I'm not going to have time to ask that question, but I was going to ask about the be required by employers. And I think we know if there are health professionals or not. Dr. John Goldman is an infectious disease specialist with UPMC. Dr. Goldman, as always, thank you very much for being on the program.
Thank you.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.